Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Republican New York State Assembly Minority Leader William Barclay. He's from the 120th District. Leader Barclay, always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me on, as always, David.
I want to, just before we begin, give you a little bit of praise because we're in a very divided time in our country. I just saw a report that says Democrats and Republicans can't agree on anything. We see how, for example, public media has been challenged by this administration, but you're one of the folks who's come on and you state your opinion. No one has to agree to have a civil discussion. And so kudos to you, Minority Leader Barclay, for continuing to come on this program, no matter what the political climate, to talk to listeners of this radio station.
Well, thanks, David. I appreciate you always giving me an opportunity to at least give my opinion on things. And I, like you, do worry about the divide that we have in this country. I think we can certainly disagree, but it doesn't have to be disagreeable to do that. And that's what I've tried to do through my political career, understanding that people may have more than one way of looking at things. But that being the case, I still feel strongly about my positions, and I try to articulate them as well as I can and bring people onto my side that I think will ultimately, in my opinion, help my district and help the state.
Well, I think between you and I, we probably agree on the first issue I want to bring up, which is redistricting. In my opinion, it should be called the gerrymander because it's been so unfair in this country. We can just use New York as an example where, you know, draw me a district where only my party can win. We know what this is all about. Now you see what's happening in Texas, trying to do it off calendar to try to secure a sure win for the Republicans in Congress. And now you got New York Governor Kathy Hochul and Gavin Newsom of California sort of leading the charge on the Democratic side. So we'll do that to you, you know, that kind of thing. I'm of the opinion that two wrongs don't make a right. You?
Yeah, well, I agree. I can't really speak to what's going on in Texas. I don't have a real in-depth knowledge there, but, you know, they're threatening to redistrict mid-decade. And the Democratic legislators left the state. I don't know where that stands. They're still out of state and they can't get a quorum.
Yeah, they're still out of state. They're still out of state. And yeah. Texas is saying, we're just going to do it over again. So what are you going to do then?
Right. I mean, they can't presumably stay out of state forever. There's going to have to be some resolve on there. But nevertheless, you know, the governor has been out there saying, well, if Texas does it, New York's going to address reapportionment and redistricting in New York. But she's overlooking one big fact, and that is we have a constitutional requirement that any so-called gerrymandering or reapportionment, redistricting, whatever you want to call it, needs to go through the Independent Redistricting Commission. So I guess she's thinking she's going to revise the Constitution in some way. It hasn't been clear really what she's proposing, other than she said she thought we ought to get rid of the independent, I emphasize, Independent Redistricting Commission so she can gerrymander. And I agree with you. That doesn't seem to be the right course of action. I'm pretty comfortable in saying if you try to amend the Constitution in that manner to get rid of the Independent Redistricting Commission, I think voters, you'd face a pretty strong voter backlash, and I think it'd be hard to change that. You'd have to get voter approval for doing that, which, by the way, they tried back in, I think it was 2020, they tried to tweak the IRC to,
right,
I think, in my opinion, to benefit them, and that went down. Voters voted against that, I think, by 55% against. So we've sort of been down this path before in New York. It wasn't successful, and I strongly doubt it'd be successful. And even if, you know, even if Texas can do it, they don't have that same constitutional constraint that we have in New York. We wouldn't, even if, you know, the voters accepted this, the legislature passed it two consecutive legislative sessions. So that means it wouldn't go into effect, I think, until 2027. You know, we're almost through the decade in that regard. So, long story, I agree with you. This is the wrong. I think it's a lot of rhetoric, frankly, a lot of political rhetoric on this. And I don't think it's going to end up anywhere, at least in New York.
I agree with you 100%. Too much of a Herculean effort to try to amend the state constitution. It probably just isn't going to happen.
Even if you wanted more Democratic representatives, I mean, the whole purpose of putting the Independent Redistricting Commission in place to try the best we can. I still think politics plays a role.
But yes, it does.
To limit the amount of the role of politics in redistricting. So putting everything aside, I think most voters would agree with it. I happen to agree with it. The best we can, let's get politics out of it and have good, fair districts that are competitive. And actually, we did a pretty good job in the assembly. I wasn't upset with our redistricting this year, but the congressional and the state senate redistricting was problematic. But long and short of it, we should have good, fair districts that make contiguous sense, that make, you know, geographic sense, that make population sense. And the best way of doing that is to get politics out of it. And we've moved that way in New York with the Independent Redistricting Commission. I don't think we ought to move away from that.
We're speaking with Republican State Assembly Minority Leader Will Barclay. And, you know, Will, one of the areas that it seems like, in New York at least, politicians may be listening to each other is when it comes to discovery. Now, New York has implemented changes to state laws that address how evidence is shared ahead of a criminal trial. You and I have talked about this a lot. Your conference has been railing about it, saying, you know, you put too much burden on the DAs and it ends up being that a lot of people get released who would have been convicted otherwise. And, you know, the governor celebrated these changes to the discovery laws, which were reformed in 2019. And I'm guessing you and your conference are happy with that compromise.
We are. You know, we'd like to see it go farther, obviously. We think a lot of the criminal justice reforms went too far. And unfortunately, for my colleagues across the aisle and their eagerness to change those laws, they never took in the input from people that are on the front lines, whether it's law enforcement or prosecutors. And so as a result, we've seen crime increase. And as you said, with the discovery laws, particularly, we've seen something like, I think in New York City, I saw a statistic the other day, something like 62% of all criminal prosecutions are dismissed under the speedy trial laws. Before that law, the original discovery changes went into effect, it was 42%. And the conviction rates are way down, too, as a result of this. So the governor asked some changes, pretty technical changes. I wouldn't profess to be an expert on them, but it does ease the burden on prosecutors as far as turning over relevant, I emphasize that, evidence to the defense. And that's the problem. Before, it was like anything under the sun had to be turned over to the defense. Obviously, just like other agencies, prosecutors are burdened by budget constraints and employment, and so they weren't able to get this information to, and as a result, a lot of cases were being dismissed. So the governor, with the agreement of, which I appreciate, of the downstate city district attorneys, was able to negotiate some changes to discovery law, which are a step in the right direction. But I would emphasize we probably need to go further. Upstate prosecutors are still troubled by, you know, I think they think you could amend that law more, so kind of relieve them of additional burdens that they don't think are relevant when they're prosecuting cases. So we'd like to see more, but it's definitely a good first step. But there's a lot of other things down there, though, Dave. We still have, you know, we still got the bail out there. We still have raise the age and a host of other criminal justice laws that we think need to be reexamined and maybe eased back from where they initially were when they passed those laws a number of years ago.
Well, because we're talking about crime and it's in the news, we see that Donald Trump is now justifying the federal takeover of policing in Washington, D.C. over crime. But statistics show a 26% drop in violent crime last year. You have, despite some of the numbers you cited, in general, overall in this country, including in New York, overall, it is down percentage-wise. So, you know, do you worry that because of Trump's push here, he might try to do that in other cities, including New York? And are we misinterpreting, are we misinforming the public when all true statistics show that crime, for the most part, you're right, there are some individual crimes and, for example, domestic assaults that are up in certain places. But overall, the trend is downward. So are we being fair by continuing to harp on it?
Well, you know, they always say about there's cliches about statistics and we can trust them. There's statistics and experts or what's the opinions. I forget what the cliche is. But, you know, I do feel like crime, they may be down, but they're also down from, you know, highs of the COVID pandemic when crime spiked substantially. So could we do a better job with crime? Without a doubt. And, you know, you can cite the statistics, but people are feeling it. And I'm certainly hearing it. I'm hearing it just from locally. And I live in a rural area where crime traditionally has not been, you know, as acute as maybe it would be in an urban area. But people are certainly feeling it. I'm not sure all those statistics would demonstrate that crime's down. You know, you see, I don't want to get a debate about statistics, but use of a firearm has been up. Certainly the car hijackings or car thefts are up. So there's certain statistics that are higher.
Yes.
I mean, there's no doubt about it. But also, I don't know the issue with D.C. I know it's a very dangerous city. I've heard that. You've seen it in the news. The police commissioner in the city, I don't know if he ever got prosecuted, but was cited for misleading statistics. So, you know, I'm not sure we're getting the most reliable facts coming out of D.C., but I think the president felt like something had to be done. And so it's our nation's capital. I don't know how much ability you'd have to take over the policing in other cities, but because it's our nation's capital and the federal government's there, I assume there's more power for the president to do that. And he feels it's an unsafe city, and a lot of other people would agree with him, and he's trying to do something about it. So I have no concern about him trying to make D.C. a safer city, and whether, you know, crime's down or certain crimes are down there, I can't speak to that. I'm just not there. But I do think there are certain crimes that are up, and I don't think in New York, particularly, as I talked about, policies like raise the age have been helpful to try to fight that crime.
Will Barclay, Assembly Minority Leader, Republican. The idea here that we feel, it feels like there's more crime. And I want to go to a place you're not going to believe. I'm going to blame the media for a second. And, you know, because we always blame politicians, and I hold some blame for them, too. But the media's criteria for what makes news is not that the 175 planes landed at the Albany International Airport safely today. It's the one that crashed. The criteria is negative. It is conflict, shootings. It is crime. And when that is the criteria, and that's what ends up on your screens every day, it creates the feeling that there's more crime than the statistics show. When you have a president of the United States calling people bloodthirsty and wild and rapists and murderers, and, you know, that has a lot of influence on how the American people think. So I think part of the blame could be the way the media chooses to report the news, as well as the way the politicians use it to get their votes.
Yeah, well, that's an age-old issue, without a doubt, and it cuts all ways. You know, I read the stories, you know, you talk about the big, beautiful bill and how terrible that's going to be in the front page of, you know, the local paper here, how, you know, desperate that's going to be on, you know, on the people that might be affected by it. And but then, you know, you see what the requirement, I don't want to necessarily get in the federal budget bill, but I'm happy to if you want to, but you know, you see, well, what are the requirements? What's that actually do? Well, it requires a work requirement for people of 20 hours, able-bodied people for 20 hours a week. I think you ask most people on the street, they say, yeah, well, that certainly seems reasonable. That seems like maybe a reasonable change. And so, but, you know, if you read the story in the paper, you would think, you know, everything's getting slashed. People are going to lose their health, federal health insurance or state health insurance. And, well, maybe they're going to lose it because they don't want to, you know, satisfy the work requirement. That's not added into the story. So I guess my general point is, sure, people always use rhetoric for political purposes, trying to persuade people to their side of the policy. And I think the media does have a lot to blame, but it has a lot to blame in all directions. It's not just, you know, maybe helping public safety talking points from Republicans, also trumpet stuff that would probably help talking points of Democratic legislators and executives.
Well, you know, I might push back a little bit on that, but I don't want to get into that kind of an argument right now. What I'd just say to you is that I've been talking to people in the food pantries areas, right? Feeding New York State, an organization that tries to feed the hungry. And there is no income level, for example, where people are hungry. It includes people who have money but may have overextended themselves, or they have a medical emergency or other things that have happened to put them in this situation. Now, in the wealthiest country in the world, you're going to really cut SNAP benefits? This is the crumbs at the bottom of the barrel, and people are hungry, and more people will go hungry. And I'm not saying it. It's the people who run the food pantries had already seen the trend. And with less funding for that, of course, more people are going to go hungry. And of course, you know, New York State does provide school meals for children. But that's not enough. And in the end, children are the ones that are hurt the most.
Well, I'm happy to talk about SNAP. I'm happy to talk about Medicaid. The question is, what's sustainable? And what is New York doing to make sure that SNAP is sustainable? I understand that what the cut is for whatever the state's failure rate is. So New York has a 15% failure rate, was my understanding. Now, that could be, and when they say failure rate, it's people that are receiving SNAP benefits who otherwise would not deserve them. And this is not all necessarily fraud. It's sometimes just paperwork or whatever they're getting it. But so should the federal government continue to subsidize New York's failure rate, or should New York get its system in place so it doesn't have 15% of people receiving SNAP benefits that otherwise shouldn't receive them? So that's what that bill does. So it's not like this harsh cutting, you know, people off SNAP that, you know, are hard times or can't afford it or otherwise.
How do we know that, Will? Well, that's what the bill says. But then when it goes through and the cuts go through and we start to see examples of people going hungry, isn't that where we should start seeing evidence? I don't think we have the evidence yet.
That's not a result of this bill. This bill simply says we're not going to subsidize a failure rate of 15%. You know, and the state agrees with the number. It's not like the number is just made up. It's the state's number. Those are people that otherwise shouldn't be on SNAP benefits. So why should the federal government continue to subsidize that?
I don't know, Will, but I think that, quite frankly, that's a ruse, because what's happening is people on the bottom are going to get hurt. They're cutting the money available. They do it under the idea, and they draw a broad brush with it.
That's not accurate. I mean, SNAP's still going to be, for those who receive it, and receive it pursuant to the rules of SNAP, which I can't speak about, they will still be able to get their SNAP benefits. The state's not going to get reimbursed for SNAP benefits for people who aren't eligible for SNAP.
So the state going to lose money?
They will, because it's currently subsidized at 115%.
Okay, so the state is going to lose money. So the state is going to lose money, and you can guarantee me that all that money that's being taken away is going just for people who don't deserve it.
Right. I mean, I'm talking big numbers here, but I don't want to get into the failure rate of our SNAP programs. I'm not, again, 100% confident that I'm correct, but I believe those are state numbers. I don't think there's any controversy over a state's failure rate in the SNAP benefit. I think the feds and the state understand. And I want to emphasize, it's not necessarily fraud. Some of this is just, you know, I don't know how many people SNAP covers, but with the millions of people that it covers, you're going to have some of those frauds. So the state needs to tighten up its system. And that's just the other thing with Medicaid, because Medicaid, I talk about sustainability of a program. And, you know, Medicaid has become a massive program. It's $126 billion. It's gone up 60% in New York over the last 4 years. Now, I ask you, is that sustainable? I don't think it is. I think at some point we're going to have to put some reforms into Medicaid, and this is what I think that bill tries to do. And then, you know, you talk about it, everybody's, well, they're slashing Medicaid. You're not slashing Medicaid. You're putting requirements in that, again, able-bodied people, you'd have to work a minimum amount. And it, by the way, it doesn't have to actually be paid work. It can be volunteer work, and it can be school, and it's 20 hours a week, which to me doesn't seem that onerous. You know, that seems like a decent reform that might be able to start curbing the expansiveness of Medicaid in this country, and particularly in New York State. You know, again, I think sometimes you look at the finer points in these bills, they don't seem as egregious as maybe it's been made out in the media and elsewhere.
Hey, I'll give you all that, and I'll give you that, you know, waste and fraud should be eliminated. I just don't want to see any legitimate people get hurt in the process because of a broad brush. Now, we'll see, obviously, what happens here.
Right.
But if we turn to what I was talking about before, which is the state money, which is getting reduced, now you got a problem in New York State, right? If the Democrats, let's put it on them, Will, how about that? If the Democrats, if the Democrats are saying there's a, you know, DiNapoli says the state is facing a nearly $35 billion budget deficit over the next 3 years. You remember that budget was $254 billion. They went along, the Democrats, almost pretending like nothing was going to happen in Washington, right? So let's say they're going to use that as a hammer in the coming elections when stuff starts to get cut. I mean, shouldn't you guys be in a special session talking about if any New Yorkers are going to be hurt by these cuts, how New York can stop that from happening?
Well, I think we should have done that probably 2 budgets ago. You know, we've been spending like drunken sailors in Albany. And when I say we should be more constrained in our spending, I'm not saying, you know, radically cut Medicaid in half or education funding or whatever. What we really need to do, and we haven't done, particularly under Governor Hochul, actually, to his credit, Cuomo is a lot more fiscally conservative in his budgets than certainly this governor has been. But we can't continue to spend. We should have stopped. Why this year? I forgot what the increase of the budget was, like 10%. Does that sound right? 10-11%. We increased our budget this year, knowing there's a potential, you know, again, a slowdown of federal aid. It's not cuts. Slowing down the growth of federal aid in New York. It seems like it would have been appropriate maybe to see that right in the wall and do something about it this budget. The good news is some of the provisions of the budget that will affect federal reimbursement, particularly in Medicaid, thinking of particularly the provider tax, I don't think go into effect until the end of 2026. So New York does have a little time to address it, but we're going to have to address that because it's certainly that particular way. Essentially what would do is providers, state would tax providers, they could put it on their Medicaid bill and get a higher reimbursement from the federal government, which again, doesn't really seem like a great way to be budgeting or making policy. But anyways, nevertheless, that was it. That is going to get cut and phased out. So we won't be able to take advantage of that. So there will be, from that, a reduction of Medicaid. But again, I think most people look at that on the street and say, well, that's crazy. You're taxing your providers in New York State so they can get more reimbursement from the federal government. Of course, the federal government wants to go along with that forever. You know, they got their own budgetary problems they got to deal with.
Well, let's move to energy, the state's energy issues, right? I know this is one you want to talk about today because of what Governor Hochul has done. She's got a plan for nuclear energy. She wants to build the first nuclear plant in New York in a generation, perhaps Western New York. They don't have the specific spot necessarily yet. She says she's charging the New York Power Authority and the Department of Public Service to work together to develop and construct the plant, which would generate 1 gigawatt of electricity and be able to power 1 million homes without adding any carbon to the atmosphere and without, quote, breaking the bank for consumers. I am guessing that you and the Republicans like this idea. Obviously, there's going to be pushback because people are worried about meltdowns and the past examples they'll pull up, including Pennsylvania and New York.
Yeah. Well, so just to show that I'm not such a hardcore partisan, I can't compliment the other side. I will compliment the governor. She's coming to the party a little late, but at least she's coming to the party. And I do think nuclear is a solution to a lot of our generation, electrical generation issues that we have in New York State and across the country. So I applaud her for proposing a new plant in New York. I serve the 120th Assembly District, which you mentioned on the top of the show. That includes 3 nuclear reactors in Oswego. And we have Ginna plant just outside my district in Wayne County. And these have been incredibly safe and efficient operating plants for decades now. And I think we should look at the example that these plants lead and cite another one here in Oswego County. I think it makes a lot of sense. We have all the infrastructure, the workforce, et cetera, here in Oswego. So it would be, seems to me, we have an operator, Constellation, here too. So it seems to me it makes a lot of sense. And we have the space. So that all these things line up that it makes a lot of sense to site it in Oswego County. And interestingly, another point is, well, you generate the electricity, it's got to go somewhere. Well, we have Micron coming in, which, if all says of what's being advertised, will require a massive amount of electricity. And it's not going to be done through wind and solar. They're just not efficient enough unless you get the storage, which isn't there yet. So we're going to have to find other means to generate electricity. And nuclear is the most efficient way to do that and with current technology. So, again, I applaud the governor and look forward to showing all the benefits of siting another nuclear plant in Oswego. And I'll be advocating for that very strongly over the next year or so. Well, the Power Authority makes this decision.
2 thoughts on this. One, I saw a documentary on the early days of nuclear when they were putting these plants together. Obviously, there are much better construction, much better design for plants today. But one of the things they pointed out, Will Barclay, is that a lot of these plants go out for bid. And the way the government always works is to get the lowest bidder. My recommendation is to get the highest bidder. Get the safest plant, the safest construction, the double core protector. If it's going to happen, we should do it the safest we can, not based on the lowest bidder.
Well, I don't know the lowest bidder. I mean, this is a highly, highly regulated business. It's so much that, you know, they have people from the Nuclear Regulatory Agency on campus full time.
Yeah, so, and yet there's been meltdowns in the past.
No, there's three. Interesting that one meltdown, it didn't cause any loss of life, was Three Mile Island, which they're starting back up again. There's risk with everything. I'm not saying nuclear is totally risk-free, but I think compared to any other type of generation, it's pretty low risk, and the return is very, very high. So I don't disagree, though. Obviously, I live here.
Let's make it safe. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. But I do feel pretty confident. You know, the Constellation plants here in my district, I've visited them many times. I've been in there. And, it's not like, I think, unfortunately, which I love the show, but The Simpsons and others have, they're showing, sort of a loosey-goosey type run organization, which does good for comedy. But in real life, if you, visit these plants, you'd see how professional and well-operated, even from, my viewpoint being, non-professional, but they don't screw around. You go in the operating room, it's like radio silence. You don't talk, you're not joking around. These people are professional people running these plants. And hence, I think it demonstrates there hasn't been any major accidents in these plants, or really since Three Mile Island, anywhere in the United States.
Well, and then the other part is just that, we shouldn't be kicking out all the other potentials to help with energy, like solar and wind and those kinds of things. And we shouldn't be taking regulations away from the environment like your friend Lee Zeldin, the EPA, is doing.
I do think we should do it all. I'm not against wind and solar, but also not to do them exclusively. Because the problem with wind and solar, which we've talked about on the show many times, is when the sun's not shining, wind doesn't blow, guess what? We don't have electricity. So you still need that base load that can provide the power. So when you come home at night, when you flip that switch, your lights turn on. Or when you plug in your hybrid, the car charges. So there has to be a dose of reality. Our demand keeps going, so we have to import power very often from high-emission CO2 emission plants like, natural gas or coal burning from out of state, and that's not good environmental law.
Will Barclay, Minority Leader of the New York State Assembly, I really appreciate you joining me once again for putting up with me, and hopefully I haven't pushed you too far this time, and we'll get you back another time.
Not at all, David. I appreciate it. I always appreciate the good conversation we have, so anytime you're willing to have me on, I'm willing to come on.
Thank you. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.